Jesus starts in this passage this way. He starts by saying, if you love me, you will keep my commandments. And that verse itself is a really good example of different choices that different groups of translators make. Because if you notice, if you read different versions of the Bible, maybe you read the NRSV, that's what I tend to read, called the New Revised Standard Version. Maybe you read the NIV, the New International Version. Maybe you read the Message, or maybe you read a New American Standard Bible, or maybe you read a Bible in not an English language. And every time somebody puts out a translation or a paraphrase or a version of the Bible in a language that is not Hebrew, Greek, and Aramaic, it's a translation. It's they've had to make choices about how to take the words from the original language and put them into a new language. And that's never a straight matter of because the words don't measure up quite that way from language to language. And so I want to start with this very first verse in 15, where Jesus says, if you love me, you will keep my commandments. If you're reading from a New International Version or New Living Translation of the Bible, your verse here will read this way. If you love me, keep or obey my commandments. That's what it says. But if you're reading the same version as I'm reading, the NRSV or maybe the New American Standard Bible, it reads this way. If you love me, you will keep my commandments. So one has a future sense to it, you will keep my commandments, and one has more of a command sense to it, keep my commandments. The difference here is in the Greek grammar, and I'm not gonna go on and on about this, but there's in Greek language there are moods to words and the way they are used. And in the NRSV version, in the if you love me, you will keep my commandment, they're recognizing that the Greek version of keep here or obey, it's also translated as obey, is in what's called the indicative mood, which means it's just a matter of fact. If you love me, this will be the result. You'll keep my commandments. That's just, it's a matter of fact. And compare that to a different mood, which is called the imperative mood, which is a command. And so there's a big difference here in how these verses are translated in different translations. If you translate it as if it's the imperative mood as a command, Jesus is saying, listen, if you love me, you will obey my commandments. Versus this kind of just a statement of fact where he's saying, hey, if you love me, this is what's going to happen. You're going to keep my commandments. It's just the way it is. Now you might be sitting there and going, really, Lane? Who cares? The difference is important because how we translate, the choices we make in words are important. If this whole keeping Jesus' commandments thing is in itself a commandment, like when the NIV, the way the NIV has translated it suggests, then what happens when I fail? What happens when I don't keep his commandments? What happens when I mess up? What happens when I ignore this command of Jesus? Versus if it's not so much a commandment as it is a statement of fact, like in the NRSV, then the question is no longer, hey, what happens to me? What's the punishment if or when I fail? But it's instead, how do I love Jesus in such a way that I will keep his commandments? It becomes this different kind of a question, so that instead of it being worrying about how on earth we're going to do this, it becomes just a, or what's going to happen to us, it becomes a how. The NRSV is a better translation, it seems. When you look back, if you have a Greek background and you look back at the Greek, it is that if you love me, you will keep my commandments. That's the mood of the word in the actual Greek. And so I want you to keep that in mind as we're going through. That Jesus isn't here threatening his disciples. He's not making some kind of statement like, hey, everybody, I'm about to leave and you've got to shape up. You've got to keep my commandments. He's saying instead, listen, this is the fact. If you love me, which you do, you're going to keep my commandments. Speaking of commandments, what exactly are Jesus' commandments? It's fascinating to me that when I was reading through various commentaries on this passage, a lot of them just kind of slide over that as if, well, it's obvious what Jesus' commandments are. And so I went back to the beginning of John's gospel and I was reading all the way through it, looking for places where John would have recorded Jesus saying, "This I command you." Because here's the thing, in the gospels, all through the things that Jesus says, there's nothing really like the Ten Commandments of the Old Testament. It would be so great if there was, if Jesus had just had a list and he just said, "Thou shalt or thou shalt not, do this, don't do this." And it was, "I command you this and I command you that." Then when he says, "If you love me, you'll keep my commandments," we'd know exactly what he's talking about. But that's not really the way that Jesus speaks. And it's not the way that John wrote his gospel. There is one really clear commandment where Jesus actually uses the word commandment. And it's in this same conversation he's having with his disciples. It's in chapter 13, verse 34. Possibly you don't even have to turn a page in your Bible to see it. In chapter 13, verse 34, this is after Jesus has washed the disciples' feet. It's after he has predicted the betrayal. And he says this, "I give you a new commandment, that you love one another. Just as I have loved you, you also should love one another." This is the one place in John's gospel leading up to when Jesus says, "You'll keep my commandments," that he actually uses the word commandment. Now, there's also an ought to or a should in John 13, which is kind of, in my mind, I think, a softer kind of a commandment. And it's in 13:14, in verse 14, right after Jesus washed all the disciples' feet. He says, "If I, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you also ought to wash one another's feet." You ought to. He doesn't say, "I command you to wash each other's feet," but he says, "Listen, this thing that I've done, you should mimic it. You should do this as well." Now, as a side note, most commentators seem to agree, at least the ones that I have read, that Jesus wasn't intending this one to be a literal commandment. "Hey, I walked around the circle and I washed everybody's feet, so every time you gather, you should also literally wash each other's feet." So often we forget that context matters in the commandments, in the oughts and the shoulds in the Bible. The context here is that Jesus was taking and putting himself in the place of a servant among his disciples. He was the rabbi, he was the teacher, he was the Messiah, and he did the job that the least of the household servant was supposed to do: wash everybody's feet after their dusty travels. It was an act of extraordinary hospitality. This is what Jesus is talking about. The context changes. What that kind of humility, what that kind of service looks like, changes based on different cultures and different times in history. So that the should, the ought to, this kind of softer sounding command, is a command to serve each other, which fits. It's parallel to that one in John 13, 34. "I give you a new commandment, that you love each other." One of the ways that we love each other is by serving each other. And so when we look at this John 14, verse 15, "If you love me, you will keep my commandments," there's this sense of loving each other, of serving each other that's part of that. That's what we get out of John's gospel. But remember that John's gospel doesn't stand alone. John never intended that his gospel would stand all by itself. Most scholars are pretty confident that John's gospel was the last of the four to be written. He was probably familiar with Matthew, Mark, and Luke and other things that were out there that had been written about Jesus as well. So I think it's fair to assert that when John shared these words of Jesus, "If you love me, you will keep my commandments," he had in mind all the instructions that Jesus had given, not just the ones that he wrote down in his gospel, but everything that Jesus had said. As an example, in Matthew 25, verses 31 to 46, if you're not familiar with this story, it's worth going back and reading when we're done today. Matthew 25, 31 to 46. We read Jesus' description of the final judgment, when all the people, all the nations of the world will be separated before them. And he uses the analogy of as a shepherd separates the sheep from the goats. He then goes on to share that those who will inherit God's kingdom are those who fed the hungry, who gave drink to the thirsty, who welcomed the stranger, who clothed the naked, who took care of the sick, and who visited those who were in prison. He didn't say, "I command you to do these things." But he is saying, listen, when all is said and done, when I come back, when God's kingdom comes here on earth as it is in heaven, there's going to be this kind of a reckoning. And here's what we're going to be looking for. These are the kind of commandments. These are the things that are expected. So even if in John 14, 15, when Jesus said, if you love me, you will keep my commandments, he didn't specifically call everything that he said a commandment. I do think that he had in mind all of these kind of things. I think when John wrote his gospel, he had in mind all the things that Jesus had instructed his disciples, regardless of whether or not they were specifically in John's gospel or they were specifically called a commandment. I think it has to do with, listen, if you love me, Jesus is saying, you're going to live in a way that honors me. If you love me, you're going to do the things that matter to me. If you love me, here's how you will live. And then you look back on Jesus' whole life and you realize, if I love Jesus, I'll live in a way that Jesus would be proud of. I'll live in a way that mirrors the way that Jesus lived. And so this passage, it continues, if you love me, you will keep my commandments, and I will ask the Father, and he will give you another advocate to be with you forever. This is the answer. Verse 16 is the answer to the question of how do I love Jesus in such a way that I'll keep his commandments? If me keeping his commandments is a matter of fact that flows out of me loving Jesus, how do I do it? Because I know, and probably you know yourselves, that I don't always keep Jesus' commandments. So how am I supposed to keep Jesus' commandments? How do I love people? How do I humble myself? How do I serve others like Jesus did? Because I honestly, I do love him. He died for me. How could I not love him? Jesus says this in response to that unspoken question, I will ask the Father and he will give you another advocate. Now, here's where we get into some more, I think, interesting Greek. Hopefully I won't throw you, especially those of you who are just on the phone and just listening to this. But again, I want to draw attention to some of the nuances of some of the words that are being spoken here. And so the word that the NRSV has translated to be advocate, if you love me, you will keep my commandments, and I will ask the Father and he will give you another advocate. The word in Greek is parakleton. I think that I'm saying that right. Parakleton is the word in Greek, or sometimes we hear the word paraclete. And that's what he's saying. I will give you another paraclete. Well, what on earth is that supposed to mean? That word is translated in different ways. In the NRSV, it's advocate. In the NIV, the New International Version, you would have read, he will give you another advocate to help. If you're reading the King James Version, you would have read, he will give you a comforter. If you're reading the New American, he will give you a helper. All of those words are part of what he's talking about here. See, the thing is that again, this word it's a big word in Greek. It covers a whole lot of things. Literally, it means the one called alongside. Jesus is saying, I will ask the Father and he will give you another one called alongside. Jesus was the first parakleton. Jesus was the first advocate or comforter or helper. Jesus was the first one called alongside. This is why he said to the disciples, he'll give you another one. Jesus came along from God to journey alongside the disciples. He came from God to be God's advocate in their presence, to be God's representative, to be God's encouragement and comfort to his disciples. And now that he's about to leave them, there's going to be another parakleton, another advocate, encourager, comforter, helper, another one who is called alongside. So this is what's going on in this passage. And he says, so I'm going to send another one of those. And then he goes on in verse 17, this parakleton, who is it? It's the Spirit of truth, whom the world cannot receive because it neither sees him nor knows him. You know him because he abides with you. This is a kind of a really neat statement that he's making here. He abides with you currently. You know him because he abides with you currently, this parakleton, this advocate, this one who has called alongside is with you because he's Jesus. And he will be in you in the future. There's a present and a future tense to this. He will also be in you because he's the Spirit. So this parakleton, this one called alongside, is at one and the same time Jesus who was with them and the Spirit who is yet to come, who will be in them. When the Spirit arrived at Pentecost in the Christian calendar is just a couple Sundays away. When the Spirit arrived at Pentecost, the disciples knew exactly who it was because they had known Jesus and they recognized Jesus in the Spirit because the Spirit and Jesus are one. They're both from and of God. This is exactly the comfort that Jesus' disciples needed. You might remember from last week that he was telling them, hey, I'm leaving you. You can't go where I'm going. Essentially, you're going to be all alone. Except here he says, I'm not going to leave you alone. God sent his Spirit to journey, to be alongside us. And just in case that's not encouraging enough for the disciples, just in case they or us are still feeling the absence of Jesus a bit too closely, he goes on in verse 18 to assure them that his absence won't be permanent. He says to them and to us in verse 18, I won't leave you orphaned. I'm coming to you. In a little while, the world, it won't see me anymore, but you will see me. Because I live, you will also live. On that day, you will know that I am in my Father, and you in me, and I in you. In verse 17, Jesus said that the parakleton, the advocate, the comforter, the encourager, will be in you. Now, here in verse 20, he says that he, Jesus, will be in you. It's important here, I think, to note that all the yous in this whole conversation, every time Jesus is saying you this and you that, he's using the plural form of the word. He's not just speaking to one person. He's speaking to the disciples as a collective group, not so much as just individuals. This is something that we in the Western world who are entrenched in individualism, who read and understand most things through the lens of individualism, we've tended to read Jesus' words as if he were only and always speaking to and about individuals, about you and about me as separate entities. Like he's saying the parakleton will be in me and the parakleton will be in you. Now, it's not that that interpretation of Jesus' words is wrong exactly. It's just that it's somehow not enough. We have to consider the context. Again, context is important of those to whom Jesus was originally speaking. And as much as they did have a clear sense of the self, of the individual, the dominant way of viewing the world was through the collectivist kind of a lens. When Jesus says in verse 17 that the parakleton will be in you, the disciples would have heard him saying first and foremost that the parakleton would be in them as a group. John, in writing this gospel, would have understood Jesus to be speaking of the church, not specifically of individuals. He would have been saying the Spirit, the parakleton, the advocate, the encouragement will be in the church, the group, who you are as a whole. Likewise, here in verse 20, they would have understood Jesus to be speaking of the group of disciples. When Jesus says, on that day, you will know that I am in the Father and you in me and I in you, they would have heard it through their collectivist ears. When John wrote these words, he again would have understood the you to be referencing the church, not simply individual Christians. On that day, he wrote, you will know that I am in the Father, and you, the church, are in me, and I in you, the church. I wonder if churches in our part of the world suffer for our failure to grasp this truth that the parakleton, the Spirit, is in the church. I think that we probably do. I think we miss that. I mean, we talk a good game about the church being a body made up of different parts, all of which are equally important and necessary. We get that image from the Apostle Paul. But if we're honest, I think we're way more comfortable talking about the parts than we are imagining what it really means that we're one body, empowered and animated by the Spirit, by the parakleton, by the one called alongside, the one who is in us. How would our lives be different if we genuinely believed that it is in the church, in the collective family of God, that the Spirit lives and is thus only in us individually insofar as we are part of the church. Furthermore, how would our lives be different if we understood that all of our own little individual local churches are like, I think of them as being a local manifestation of the larger church, which is the entire family of God, all the people all the way around the world who call God their father, who call Jesus their brother and the Lord of their lives. If we understood, truly understood, that the Spirit, the Parakleton, came to the church and to the smaller local manifestations of that church, before we focused on the Spirit coming to us as individuals, how would that change the way that we live our lives? How would that change what our churches look like? How would that change the way that we interact with each other or the way that we try and be the church? How would it change the way that we are Walmer Road Baptist Church? Just something perhaps to think about and have a further conversation when we're done today. In closing off this section of this conversation between Jesus and his disciples, Jesus returns again in verse 21 to where he began in verse 15. It's kind of bookends to this little piece of this dialogue. He says this in verse 21, "They who have my commandments and keep them are those who love me." Sounds similar to those words in verse 15, doesn't it? Remember there, Jesus said, "If you love me, you will keep my commandments." Now here, he rearranges those same words, which helps with the clarity we were seeking back in verse 15 with all the different translations. This whole keeping Jesus' commandments isn't so much a command in itself as it's a statement of fact. In verse 15, "If you love me, you will keep my commandments." Now here in verse 21, "Those who have my commandments and keep them are those who love me." It goes both ways. How can you tell somebody loves Jesus? In the way that they behave, in the fact that they keep Jesus' commandments, in the way that they love each other, in the way that they feed the hungry and clothe the naked and welcome the stranger, and all of those things that Jesus exhibited in his own life. Those that love Jesus will keep his commandments. Those who keep his commandments are those who love them. And those who love me, Jesus is saying, will be loved by my Father. And I will love them and reveal myself to them. Again, this isn't anything other than fact. Loving Jesus results in keeping his commandments, which are essentially about loving each other and loving others. Loving Jesus results in us becoming his brothers and sisters, and in that way being adopted by his Father so that his Father who loves him becomes our Father who loves us. This is the thing that Jesus' disciples need to hear. Even though Jesus was leaving and going somewhere they couldn't follow, for us, even though Jesus isn't physically present with us, even though the disciples themselves knew that they would prove less than trustworthy, less than committed, with one of them betraying Jesus and another one of them denying Jesus, we know we prove less than trustworthy. We know that we don't follow Jesus' commandments, that we fail to love each other, to love other people all the time. This encouragement that they would be loved by Jesus' Father and by Jesus is our encouragement as well. Even if Jesus isn't physically present with us, even if we betray him, even if we deny knowing him, even if we fail to feed the hungry, all of that, we know that we are loved by Jesus' Father and by Jesus. And we know this love, just like they knew this love, because of the presence of the Parakleton, of the Spirit, of the one called alongside, of the encourager, of the helper who is in them and who is in us. This is incredible, important, and good news. We need to realize that we are loved deeply by God, because in being loved, we in turn love. And if we love Jesus, then we will follow his commandments. Then we will love each other. We will serve each other. We will love the world that God is loving, that God is on mission to save, that God is on mission to heal, that God is on mission to turn into his kingdom. That's what this is all about.